嗨，
Hey, Slava Ukraini.
hello, I'm Slava.
How have you been? I know that you walked during a large solidarity rally in London.
We're very glad that I was, at the march in London at the Solidarity March together with my parents and some of my family. But I think for me it was a bit. Actually, I was going to say bittersweet, but it was more bitter than sweet because, I was walking and, everyone was sort of standing in solidarity with Ukraine and some people were speaking, politicians and civil society leaders about how amazing the response of the UK has been and of London and all these things. And, as someone who had to fill in about maybe eight different applications over the last, no, 72 hours, I was like, guys, come on, you have not been that welcoming in terms of, helping people who are immediately fleeing or people who are still in Ukraine and who want to leave. And so it was just a little bit of a weird feeling for me because, I understand that, ordinary people are doing as much as they can, but it was still quite shocking, is quite shocking, personally, as someone who's been in the UK for the last 15 years and has paid taxes to the UK government, it just hurts me a little bit. And I'm currently waiting for I'm trying to get my best friend and my goddaughter, so her daughter, into the UK. And just the anxiety of waiting and filling out and all the stuff is just taking a toll. But I know we don't ask this here, but I'm gonna ask it anyway, maybe in a slightly different way. But anything, Maxim, you feel like you would like to share with everyone before we start, or
Yeah,
any updates?
before we introduce our today's featured Ukrainian, I wanted to share a bit about the same kind of alienation feeling that I experienced because I'm not in Ukraine, but I travel these days among various European capitals trying to rally support and solidarity for Ukraine in many ways, including fundraising. And I've been just this week I've been to Berlin, and something that I felt there I put on Twitter thread because I felt like this is something that many Ukrainians feel, and this is extreme alienation that I felt there. Although I love Berlin, but you go there and this is genocide happening in the middle of Europe, and for people there it's no more than some disturbing headlines. You can tune out if you need and keep living the same life they do. They work, go into a cafe, drink coffee, clubs, birthdays. And it reminded me of a similar scene I've actually seen in Moscow some years ago. The day after Putin murdered Boris Nemtsov, which was Russian opposition leader, that was my last time traveling to Moscow. It was 2015, February, late February. And it's been already a year of Russian invasion of Ukraine, but I found the city 100% unbothered, living its usual comfortable life. Even anti-war Russians were treating it as a, small talk conversation, nothing more. And I remember one former Moscow friend now, acutely anti-Putin, and he told me, let's not even spend the whole day talking about news and politics, and it happened while our people were mass slaughtered in Donbas. And I was so disgusted in that trip, I realized Russia is so blind, there's no point engaging until Moscow, I don't know, literally burns down. But I see the same kind of blindness now in Western capitals. I don't expect, of course, everyone to pause their lives. This is not what you do in the face of terrorism anyway. But the way they feel, the way they feel, it's a bit alienating. I feel like at home now in Warsaw and Prague or Bratislava, but this is not the same in Berlin or Amsterdam. And, a lot of people volunteer, show up for protest, but they sometimes do it for different reasons that we do here in the east of the European Union.
Yeah, you're totally right. That's exactly the feeling. It's kind of like, why exactly are we all here? And it just feels like, as much as I want to thank everyone for supporting us, it just still feels a little bit like there's a disconnect, right, between how we feel and how a lot of the world feels. But I'm really excited about our guest for today, and I think Maxim, you were gonna introduce Timofey as well, and we can jump in.
Timofey is with us at the moment, right? Timofey, you're with us?
Yes.
Hey, друже, слава Україні.
Hello, слава.
Timofey Milovanov, I don't think, I mean, for Ukrainians, he doesn't need any introduction. He's like a towering figure for many, you know, a legendary name in terms of Ukrainian reforms. He's a former minister of economy, but he's mostly, you know, known for me as an extremely brilliant Ukrainian who I always had the most admiration here in Ukrainian spaces, that we let our featured Ukrainians to just, you know, introduce themselves and to say what they want to say about themselves first and foremost. So, Timofey, what would you say about yourself that you want the rest of the world to know at the moment?
You know, I want to win the war. I want Ukraine to win the war so that we can finally leave a normal life. And I think we have a good chance because it's for the first time in so many centuries we actually have Ukrainian government. It's for the first time when you see that, you know, a call for resistance, a call for the nation, or a call for support in something, call to arms, it says .gov.ua. And I think before, we always, even in 2014, 2013, and then before that, 2004, or during the Soviet Union, before the 90s. And last century, in 1917, 1918, we always had some kind of other governments, you know. And before that, in the 19th century, we had the Tsarist government. So it always was some other government trying to suppress us. We always had some kind of colonial imposition on us. And but I think that's the first time we actually have a standing chance as a nation.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, what I want to say.
Look, I wanted to like ask you about, because this time we decided to decolonize our views on how to be properly in solidarity with Ukraine. And there is one thing you do on Twitter that I love, and actually that is how I end up inviting you, is that like regularly you post threads on Twitter where you kind of, you know, go into your main takeaways after a day of what you learned, what you realized is happening in Ukraine. And one that you posted on March 24, it was also something about help that Ukraine is getting or not getting from our friends and allies. And one of the, you know, kind of takeaways that you posted, you say international humanitarian agencies are inadequately slow and wasteful. They deliver what they have, not what is needed. Think specific medical supplies where and when they can. Think rear area hospitals. Example, I have personally requested several embassies, including to yes, to address a request for life-saving medical kits, and response was very slow. Can you tell us more about this frustration and how you came about?
So I think the existing infrastructure, international infrastructure, is okay for structured threats. And Russia has found a way to hack it. By having a hybrid warfare, and it's on all in multiple domains. Let me make it specific. So, a international agency, or let's say an embassy, a country would say we're okay. We kind of delegate, we appropriated some funds, and they will go through a humanitarian agency. But the threats on the ground are changing so fast that, you know, one day you need this specification of medical kits or medical supplies, the next one you have another one, and the day after that you have yet another one, and I think the agencies are not capable of handling that. And I've been in meetings with European bureaucrats with embassies on the calls, where they were openly and almost aggressively frustrated that Ukraine is sending them different lists every, you know, 2 days, and they send, you know, we've already seen 12 letters from you, and every time it's a different specification. I'm like, man, this is going to be fucking different every time, because, you know, it's changing. Because Russia is, you know, is not running a conventional warfare. You know, they attack in one area and then they're using different, you know, in the beginning that was this need, and then they changed something and they start shelling civilians. And now there is a threat of a chemical attack or not, you know, and now they are, you know, they didn't touch anything and suddenly they blew up the hospital. So you have another need. And then pharmaceutical production plants, and then we don't have something else. And, you know, it's very, very fluid. And the way you really have to operate is you need to accept the reality that at the moment you appropriate the funds and you pay, by the time it gets to the company which is, you know, which invoiced it, you might need to reconsider the specification. Once it's shipped and once it gets delivered to Ukraine, then you might need to send it to a very different location or agency that requested it. And so you have to set up a kind of, you know, you have to work in a certain way. You have to work in bulk. You have to work, you have to focus on the skeleton of the needs. Each agency or each fund, each person has to acquire specific expertise in certain areas. So, for example, we're not shipping anything except certain type of bulletproof vests, certain type of helmets, and then a certain type of medical kits. We're just not doing anything else because that allows us to have a lot of idiosyncratic information and process it. And I think no Western agency is ready to deal in this, so they all get paralyzed. And that's really frustrating. And then the last thing which gets truly frustrated is then when they go, you know, on a weekend break. And that really gets on my nerves, but, you know, it is reality. What can I do?
Yeah. And also... Just to add, I was just going to say that, you know, knowing how from experience how bureaucratic and slow some of these organizations are on a daily basis, you know, even like if we talk about super simple tasks, you know, I work in from the comms and marketing side of you in some of these organizations. And it's just like even getting a press release approved takes, I don't know, 12 hours. Can you imagine how in sort of unprepared some of these organizations, heavily bureaucratic organizations are for things like a war, as you said, a hybrid, right? Like things that constantly shift and change from an hour to an hour. So I was just wondering what you thought would be, you know, now we are in the situation that we are in, but what do you think is could be potentially a solution to some of these problems and some of these slowness of big international NGOs who provide aid and so on?
I think the local NGOs will take over gradually. So, you know, and, you know, that's just going to be the reality. Those who move faster will deliver the results, and there will be a lot of shaming on, you know, on the inability of large NGOs to deliver things. And it's not just NGOs, you know, it's just, so here's an example. There's 500, you know, half a billion euros appropriated for support. And, you know, first week or 2 weeks, I've heard this story that, oh, you know, don't even worry about this all humanitarian support or helmets or bulletproof vests, because, you know, currently in Europe, the EU gave funds for this and everyone is buying it out, you know, and everything will be bought out and, you know, it will be shipped to you. So just relax and enjoy. 2 weeks later, it turns out nothing is being shipped. And why it's not being shipped? Well, this is because actually the EU does have a reimbursement mechanism. And the governments have to apply to this reimbursement mechanism. But the governments have not yet set up their own reimbursement mechanism for the suppliers to be reimbursed by their local governments, by a country. Mm-hmm. And of course, 2 weeks time for Europe, for the EU, it's unprecedentedly fast. But for Ukraine, in 2 weeks time, you have, you know, thousands, if not tens of thousands, people dead. So, you know, how are you going to respond to this? You're not going to be able to change the procedures because in order to be able to take risks and respond really fast, you have to have enough trust and you have to have enough understanding of the facts on the ground, and international agencies don't have that. And I can tell you another example. It took 2 years, I think, Crown agents and some other guys
international to start supplying, you know, to fulfilling procurement contracts for Ukraine. When Ulyana Suprun was the minister, there was a big scandal that some of the international suppliers just, you know, screwed up the supplies because this, you know, they're really, you know, it takes time for them. Once it's, they're very institutionalized. So think of this as regular military versus special ops. And the way Russia is running the disruptions in Ukraine before the war and the war, it's a lot of very fluid theater action. And so you need to respond the way the Ukrainian military responded, with a lot of very, you know, decentralized, quick response forces. If you fight it or resist in kind of regular, conventional way, you're going to be slaughtered. And that's why the Russian military has been slaughtered, because they're, in some sense, they're conventional when they attack. Yeah, they disrupt in non-conventional ways, and Ukraine responds in non-conventional. But whenever there is conventional approach, it's not working in the hybrid warfare. Yeah. And the same is true for agencies international. They're really conventional. They're well set up for a slow-moving environment, for a slow-moving theater of the Cold War setting. It's not Cold War anymore. You know, there are no clear lines, there are no clear borders, there's no clear theater. Things are changing by day, by hour. So they have to be reformed.
This is a problem, is even for those agencies that are designed to handle military conflicts and assist during wars, like, for example, Red Cross. This is one of the scandals that is now out in public, because as you said, it's okay to be unprepared a week before the war, that many knew this coming. It was okay to be unprepared 1, 2, 3 days into the war. Now it's more than a month, and still we have such big organizations like Red Cross not present on the ground whatsoever. And we together, you know, now it's over 1,000 people who signed this public appeal from Ukrainian civil society, journalists, myself included, calling for Red Cross to clarify why in the hell they are not in Mariupol. Why in the hell there are tens of millions of fundraised money on their bank accounts that are not getting to Ukraine? And, this is one of the those kind of situations when we see that, you know, meanwhile, they go to Moscow and shake hands on helping Russia to handle the filtration caps in Rostov. So I think the question of reforms is just wide and open. And I think, yeah, that we have so many initiatives already on that do that job for international organizations, and maybe they should look into helping them instead of, you know, doing it or trying and failing to do it themselves.
Yeah, I agree. This Red Cross story is to put it diplomatically, a little bit embarrassing that they move out of Mariupol. And so, you know, okay, they went to Russia and they're helping, you know, you can have different takes on this. The optics are bad, that they're enabling Russia, in fact, to move people forcefully from Mariupol to Russia. This is really bad because, you know, I don't see Red Cross setting up camps and supporting it even outside of Mariupol, okay, not in Mariupol, but, you know, outside of Mariupol, at least be symmetric. And then, you know, the void is being filled in by Ukrainian NGOs and volunteers on the ground, right? So people are delivering or trying to deliver, and some are dying delivering medical supplies to Mariupol, and some get tortured and arrested and kidnapped, and it's full of names, the social space. So, you know, someone picks, you know, fills in the void, and these are Ukrainians. And, you know, I think these guys should be financed.
Yeah, it's true. We deliver bulletproof vests for journalists. And I travel around in those fundraising meetings, and all big press organizations saying, oh, we deliver tons of shit to Ukrainians. You know, like vests, whatnot, everything, you know, we deliver, we fundraise tens of millions. But in the reality, 9 out of 10 journalists I know still don't have anything. Journalists in Severodonetsk and further to the east have nothing. No vests, no helmets, no batteries, nothing. So I sometimes wonder, what is also kind of a PR exercise on behalf of those large organizations who want to show the rest of the world that they're doing something. But we all know that a lot of shit is being just jammed and, you know, stuck in warehouses in Poland or Slovakia, whatnot, not being able to cross the border because nobody's prepared to handle the logistics during the wartime.
I've heard stories like that. Everyone was delivering tactical med, but then I talked to the Minister of Health and to the now everything is under the control of military administration. So, you know, to the commander of medical army corps or something like that, which means it's really doctors who are doing supplies, but they are now all, you know, under the command to allocate the supplies more efficiently. So you know, I'm like, should we even bother with medical kits? And they're like, you know, everything which is supplied, or most of it was supplied, is not what we need. Because people supply what they have, not what they need, and they feel good about it. So it's a lot of feel good. There is a similar thing kind of with the economic support and post-war recovery. Everyone is working on post-war recovery, but we don't need post-war recovery if we really need okay, you want to work on the economy, fine, help us with building storage and shelter for internally displaced people in Western Ukraine. Can we do it now? No, the IFIs are saying, no, we can't, because it's a war. So what we can do, we can spend right now money and put a very high-profile people thinking about how to recover it later. And this is a little bit, cheap. But also, in fact, I think that's another example where you need to reform these institutions. Because what we have seen in the east of Ukraine, in Lugansk and Donetsk Oblast, that it's been 8 years since the invasion there. And those recovery projects have not worked very well, right? Have they? I don't think so.
Yeah. We were just before we jumped on a call with you, Maxim and I were just discussing what we should ask you about. And one of the main questions, we didn't know whether you would want to dive deeper into this, was exactly what you're saying, which is basically what didn't work over the past 8 years and what can we recommend to Western, whether that is donor organizations or other organizations, in terms of what they need to do. And I guess one of your recommendations is, as you're saying, focus on right now, right? Instead of like...
Yeah, and on specifics, good. You know, right now, for example, you know, it's actually easy to do if you start thinking in terms of MVPs, minimal viable products, and... you know, if you're talking about medical kit supplies and you want to supply them, just please make sure that you coordinate the specifications with someone in the military or, in the Ministry of Health. Not at the level of a hospital where you, turned out to know, you know, you happen to know some person, or not with your favorite American, Israeli, or Lebanese hospital, because I've had these guys, you know, I've seen stories of, and they've told me stories of saying, oh, you know, Ukrainians don't know anything. We've talked to people who work in, you know, Lebanon, and they told us how the medical kit really has to look and what has to be in it. And we shipped $6 million worth of it. I'm like, it's great. But that's because our paramedics are staffed differently and have different ingredients. Those things don't work, okay? So you just wasted $6 million. You send things which have extra ingredients, and you send things which don't have critical ingredients. Furthermore, you congested logistics and storage. This is great. And it doesn't matter because there's no accountability. The accountability is not based on the needs on the ground. The accountability is based on the average standards in the world. So, you know, you kind of average out of what was needed in, you know, in Syria, what was needed in Afghanistan, what was needed in Iraq, and you say it looks the same, so it looks good, it's going to pass the audit, it's going to pass the standard.
Yeah.
That's waste. If it passes the US standards, it's waste. If it passes any standard, it's waste. It has to pass domestic standard, and you have to get someone who is a ministry in the government in Ukraine, sign off on what you are delivering and saying this is what we needed, and issue you a receipt that that's what the government or someone in the government needed. If you don't get that, it's waste. Assume it is waste. And so this is the kind of reform which needs to be done.
where people who confirm the quality are not people who are averaging out experiences over the last 20 years in different areas, but rather people who are on the ground. And so you need to establish those frameworks. So that's one reform which needs to be done. So the kind of audit and accountability has to be done differently.
You know, I'll be less diplomatic, although the humanitarian assistance at the moment to Ukraine is a fucking mess. And it is a fucking mess exactly because of the same reason you're saying it was the case even the years before that, that too few Ukrainians are consulted or before those projects and those initiatives arrive at our doorstep. And I don't understand. I mean, I understand why still after 8 years of these mega development projects that were working in Ukraine, we still end up with the same problem we had in 2014, where someone is trying to do something for us without ever asking us or consulting us or getting a simple sign off from us on those issues. Also wanted to ask Timofey, because you know you're also a prominent academic and you've been also outspoken about the solidarity that foreign academic institutions have or do not have when it comes to Ukraine. So what frustrates you the most these days about that?
So I think people mean very well and are willing to expend resources, time, effort. But we need to, similarly to the case of humanitarian relief and assistance, we need to make sure that this effort is well spent. So here's one, and it's coming from blind spots. You know, it's coming from kind of intellectual laziness sometimes in terms of thinking. It's coming from, I'm going to use the economic jargon, it's coming from the supply side. People think it's the same story as with these medical kits. You know, we're going to do what we can, not what's needed. Because we don't know what's needed, and we don't know how to find out what's needed, and or we don't want to, or we think we know better, or something like that. So here's one example. We receive an email saying that there will be a special issue of a prominent journal on, you know, for academic papers on the situation in Ukraine. And the editors will be an American and a Russian who is currently a top academic in Russia and who on his social media said things like that, you know, we have to be apolitical, we have to be careful, there will be no statements from my institution. Oh, no. And this guy now is going to handle, you know, academic submissions, you know, on Ukraine. There's not a single Ukrainian on the special issue board. And a Russian who is saying that he's going to be apolitical, but war is bad, and that's his statement, and that's his last statement on social networks on the day of the invasion, and then nothing. This guy is going to be now in charge, and he's in Russia located, okay? So that's one example. Another example, another prominent Russian economist outside of Ukraine is having a panel with a prominent, you know, a guy like Thomas Piketty or someone like that, Paul Krugman, that kind of level. And then going to discuss Ukraine. And they are asking us to be in the audience, you know. You know, we shame and blame them, and then they invite us. We say, you know, are you fucking kidding us? We have no discussion of Ukraine without Ukraine. So they have this blind spot. Here's another discussion in LSC. I'm sitting, it's a closed panel about what to do, you know, Russia, Ukraine, bridges, academics, you know, how do we undo Putin, things like that. And everyone is saying that, you know, these numbers about how many Russian soldiers died and they're not working, no one believes that. And the right way to approach it would be, you know, to help Ukraine convey this message, how many Russians are dying, so that mothers and fathers in Russia start realizing, you know, the hell that, you know, their country is in. And so in order to make it real, we have to create a website where specific names of specific Russian soldiers are. And, you know, we're going to list them and then will people see it. And this is fine. And I'm telling people, you're being, you know, almost racist. You know, you're just kind of ignoring us. And it's like, in what sense we're ignoring Ukraine? We are trying to make sure that Russia stops, and we show that your military is, you know, is is powerful and resisting and killing all these guys, and we are trying to bring this message home to Russian mothers. I'm like, yes, but are we going to do a website with Ukrainian soldiers' names too? It just fucking didn't appear to them that there are Ukrainian soldiers and their names also are important. And if we're gonna have an LSE special group which has more credibility than Ukrainian and Russian government accounts about how many Russians were killed, maybe we also want to have a special LSE group about how many Ukrainians died. That didn't even cross their mind, okay? Man. And so that there are tons of cases like that. It's a blind spot. It's a very colonial perspective, which just don't exist. You know, here's a letter by a bunch of Nobel Prize winners recently signed 2 or 3 days ago from academics in the West. Many of them are Russian ethnic, originally from Russia, saying, you know, many people in Russia are saying that the West wants the Russians to be miserable, especially academics. No, we don't. We believe there is a lot of talent in Russia, especially in academia. And after the war, we will work with you to. And I'm like, you know, guys, can't you issue at least a letter that right now you can work with Ukrainian academics? The same story, you know, somehow Russian academics, there is talent there, yeah. You know, they have 130 million people. We have 40 million people. Don't we have comparative, just purely out of statistical, you know, genetic reasons? Don't we have talent too in our country? No, they're not engaging with us. They're waiting to engage with Russians after the war. MIT pulls out from Skolkovo, but is not willing to enter Ukraine. And I can tell you cases and cases of this. It's all over the place. So they still treat us as a kind of second-rate country. And then, you know, in Russia, there's talent in Russia, and it's a disaster what's happening. But somehow they forget that there's talent in Ukraine. So that gets on my nerves a little bit.
Yeah, it happens every day. I just, you know, yesterday I was like at this Russian colonialism talk, which was the first time ever in 80 years of me talking about this, that was 100% fully with Ukrainian speakers, Ukrainian artists, academics, because this never happens. You know, the majority of talks that still are happening there are, you know, full of Western, at best, Western speakers who explain us Ukraine back. And if there is a Ukrainian, usually one Ukrainian, a token one, that they give like 5 minutes to, you know, to explain what the situation on the ground, and then, you know, with kind of attitude, oh, you're too traumatized and emotional. Of course, you cannot engage in now in good debate about your own country. So here's like, let's move on to our esteemed Western speakers to talk about Ukraine. But then there is a worst case, and I said I had to say numerous times no in the last month to the events that have Russia in the title and Russia-centric that is still presented as if it is a solidarity with Ukraine event. And I keep asking why in this situation you keep dragging us into the same conversation space with people who are not dying or not, you know, whose countries are not suffering from genocide. This is just plain insulting. The programs that also set up now, that I had a huge scandal in Berlin when I was there, when they tried to set up a program of helping academics fleeing Russia and Ukraine. And this is the same fund, split 50-50. To help those academics to find new academic hole in Germany. Why in the hell you treat academics from the country that is experiencing genocide the same as, you know, the same you treat Russian academics who are just, you know, fleeing maybe at a worst case scenario, a criminal case against them, but in reality, just because there is no IKEA or Starbucks anymore, and this is not very comfortable for them to live there.
Yeah, so, you know, I want to add on this because there's the issue with what the Western academic institutions are trying to do. They essentially are facilitating brain drain from Russia and Ukraine because they could have offered joint projects for academics, let's say, who are in Ukraine or who
outside of Ukraine, and that could have been a focus. And the secondary area could have been, oh, if you're relocating, we can give you money to relocate, and we can offer you, you know, an institution of your choice. But this is not how institutions are set up. What they are offering an emergency postdoc position, professor position, something, come to us. They're not offering funding to do academic research or to have joint projects. They are offering relocation. So that's not help. That's brain drain.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I was just going to say that, you know, our next question to you was going to be about around media, but I just wanted to say that, you know, I think what we're discussing here, academia or not, or culture or media or anything, it's the same situation, right? It's not something that's exclusive just to the academia world. It's literally the same people, you know, the same Russia expert for all the outlets, for all the TV channels, for all the magazines and publications. It's just the same sort of approach across the board that we're seeing in everything, in every single part of, you know, the way that the West interacts with us. So I think as well, just a little sort of story from recent times for myself is I was invited to speak at some at a Stanford Business School alumni event, and I was just telling them about my personal story and about the fact that, you know, my grandma just escaped the war in Kyiv and sadly passed away after crossing the border, and, you know, extremely personal, emotional story. And then the first question I get from the audience is, so how are you going to deal with the hatred that's spreading towards Russian people in the West and outside of the West? What do you think about it? And I was like, guys, honestly, I'm not sure that I'm emotionally capable of answering this question. But also, just to say, I think to everyone in our audience, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who host some of these events who are part of the academic world and the media world, we just, I think all of us are just asking you, which is why Maxim and I are doing these Twitter spaces, just try to ask us as well how we feel, how we are, and our perspectives on what is happening in the world in Ukraine, and sort of really listen to what we have to say, because I think soon we're going to start rejecting invitations to a lot of places, or, you know, causing some, how would you say it, Maxim? I don't know. Uprisings, yeah. in the media world, so
yeah, it's like an anti-colonial big middle finger to that kind of shit. Yeah, Timofey, we wanted to ask you about the media coverage. Do you have anything to say specifically? What would you do differently if you were Western media covering it? I mean, I'm not even asking about, you know, Russian media or anything like
I think
that.
The angle there is that it's tragedy, and we're continuously surprised at resilience. And I think a better angle would be to acknowledge that this is a functioning country during the war, fighting for its independence. And there is at least several hundred years history to that. And it's a success story already. I think that should be the angle. I understand it's much easier to parade Ukrainians as some kind of monkeys for entertainment, rather than take them seriously and maybe learn from them how you can function during these extreme circumstances and how you can build a state despite continuous harassment from Russia over the last 30 years, and how you can have the the skeleton of the society after the Soviet Union and Stalin and World War II and Nazis and Holodomor and Holocaust and how is it that you are a nation shaped by this experience? Because, you know, if we talk to some other nations, that's the conversation we would have. How this experience have shaped you, and how do you, you know, think about yourself as a nation? How do you function? Even specific things. Why is it that your banking system didn't collapse when the country was bombed? Why is it that, there was no run on bank Because in any country, in the United States, after 9/11, there was a run on banks. You know, why didn't we have a run on banks? What did the central bank do to ensure that? Why is it that there was gas on the day of the invasion, even though everyone was standing in lines? Why there is the gas at the pump for every day ever since, despite the fact that Russia continues to bomb supply routes? Why is that?
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
This deeper perspective is a must need, especially through the lenses of Russian colonialism and very long history of that, even before 90s, before Soviet times, which was all consequent, you know, stages of the same colonial machine that was working to oppress the neighborhood. But also, I'm also kind of, this is not a question, just kind of a concern, that I am concerned that this constant focus on death and violence will eventually lead to the same situation we had after 2015, where Ukraine has been perceived through the victim lenses for many years afterwards, and nobody wanted to talk about anything except the war. And it is much appreciated, of course, and the level of atrocities this time are just unparalleled. However, there are many stories of resilience and many stories of people doing the good things and surviving, but also thriving as well, despite everything. And I think this focus is still lacking, especially in Western media. These kind of stories have to be told.
For sure.
Absolutely.
I think it's also what Timofey just said, which is that Ukraine, you know, we need to start looking at it as a success story now, today, not you know, waiting for what's going to happen next, but really start looking at, you know, the way that the civil society has organized itself, you know, the way that people have stood up to defend their cities, the way that, I don't know, humanitarian aid within Ukraine has been working, the way that government officials have responded. Just so many different lessons learned, I think, for the world as well, that are successful, that I think we just need to keep talking about. And I think the only people that can truly talk about it is people like Timofey, like some of our guests from before, who, you know, work in this, have seen it happen, and people who understand sort of the situation, I guess, in Ukraine. So I think we're running out of time. We don't want to keep everyone for too long. And this was pretty amazing, I guess, for everyone. And I this is a bit of a, I guess, philosophical question for Timofey, but I just wanted to ask you, we ask this to each one of our guests, and it's something that gives us just an opportunity to show the world a little bit about, you know, the way that we lived and thought and grew up before everything kicked off. And we usually ask people, what does, you know, Ukraine mean to you, and sort of what are the values that really, you know, highlight Ukraine's spirit for you personally, Timofey?
I think Russia helps us underscore it. In 2014, I thought that, you know, maybe our idea that we resist Russians, it's a bad national idea, but my thinking about it, and some people are saying maybe for a while it's not such a bad national idea, because I was asking the question, what's our national identity, what's our national idea? But I think this comparison with Russians it makes it very, very clear. We have experience as the nation of Ukrainians of successful resistance to authoritarianism and dictatorships. And it doesn't really matter if it is Russia or our own government. So we resisted in 2004, we resisted in 2014. So we have an experience of successful revolutions, and things, you know, during those revolutions looked really, really dark. During 2014 revolution of dignity, things were, you know, not looking good. The government was using everything it had, from police to even secret police to security services, to kidnap, harass, even shoot people. And we resisted, and we know that if we keep pushing, then it might mean that many of us will die, but there will be another day and things will get better and we will win.
So we have this learned experience of success. Russia also has revolutions, but, you know, and some of this in their history revolutions were successful, but their revolutions are very different from ours, and they might be 100 years apart, but, you know, their revolution brings terror to power. Our revolutions bring democracy to our nation. And then both us and them are willing to die. Even now, Ukrainians are willing to die to defend essentially freedom. And Russians are willing to die too, because they get in these tanks or in these trucks and they drive in Ukraine and they die. But they are willing to die for other reasons. They are dying because they are not willing or they are afraid to disobey the order. And they are definitely not dying for some kind of notion of freedom. They are dying for some kind of notion of a great Russia. But I think this is the cultural difference between us dying for freedom and them dying for greater Russia. So I think for us, what defines Ukrainians is the value of freedom.
Thank you so much. That was extremely powerful in summarizing.
I want to say thank you, friend. It's always a privilege to talk to you, and thank you for doing this as well. Yeah, that's all for me.
Well, thank you, and it's my moment to pitch, you know, our fundraising effort. Yeah. So please, it's pinned at my tweet, on my profile. So please donate. Yeah, and let others know that you can donate. We spend all the money we raise outside of Ukraine for medical kits. These are medical kits whose specification is verified and confirmed by the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Defense. And these are specific kits which will stop blood loss during the cluster munition or missile attacks in Ukraine on civilians and military and everyone and children and elderly. And most people there die from blood loss, because what happens is that when there's a cluster munition or there is a missile, you either die immediately or most likely you get cut. And so you on the spot, you have, you know, 10, 20, 30 people who are bleeding. And some are bleeding severely. And if you don't stop the bleeding immediately, people die from blood loss. And so you need special medical kits, first aid kits, which are chemically and mechanically set up to stop the bleeding. And that's what we are doing. That's what we have acquired knowledge, how to deliver it to the front lines. We can deliver it to every place except Mariupol, to Sumy, Kharkiv, Chernigov, Mykolaiv, and we can deliver what's needed. So please support and please spread the word, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
As Timofey says on that tweet, your contribution of just $100 for some, it's nothing, is very likely to save a life in Ukraine. So please, yeah, check that. I've retweeted it as well, and check on Timofey's profile. If you haven't subscribed yet, please do. He's key voice.
Thank you so much. And I just wanted to say for everyone, since we did start this space to, as Maxim says, decolonize some of the conversations around Russia, Ukraine, and I can't believe I said Russia first, Ukraine and in general Russian imperialism, Maxim's thread, the thread of all threads on this topic, I just retweeted it before this session. So if you haven't seen it and you want to learn more about why we're here and what we're talking about and background information, please check it out. I think it's also pinned on Maxim's Twitter page, but that's some further reading for everyone for next time. And yes, as both Maxim and Timofey said, please donate to the cause that that Timofey just said, the aid kids. And we just hope that we will end this war soon and we will be able to start rebuilding. But for now, let's do what people need. So thanks, everyone.
Yeah, Slava Ukraini.
Heroyam Slava.
Heroyam Slava. Thanks.